Retirement Conversation focuses on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join Joe and Dennis and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who have created interesting second acts. You'll take away practical ideas and tips to create your own. At Retirement Wisdom, we as retirement coaches help people think through their transition into retirement, as well as those who are in the early part of retirement but are looking for more from this stage of their lives. To find out more about us and how we can help you, you can schedule a free, no-obligation consultation with us. Simply go to retirementwisdom.com. On the top left corner, click on Get a Free Consultation. We would welcome the opportunity to speak to you. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Today's guest on the Retirement Conversation is international best-selling author Carl Honoré. Carl has been published in 34 languages and landed on bestseller lists in many countries. His books show why faster is not always better, and how slowing down can help us lead richer, happier, and more productive lives. His latest book, Bolder, explores the many upsides of aging, and yes, there are upsides.
Carl, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So I'm curious, what led you to transition to a slower approach to life?
Well, we're going back a few years now, but at the time I was stuck in fast forward, so every moment of my life had become a race against the clock. And I just knew this was wrong, and I wasn't really enjoying it or feeling right. But I had a wake-up call, and it came when I started reading bedtime stories to my son. And in those days, I really just couldn't slow down. So I'd go into his room at the end of the day, and I would speed read Snow White, right? I'd be, you know, skipping lines or paragraphs. I became an expert in what I call the multiple page turn technique, you know, where you try to get three or four, and it, you know, it never worked. My son knew the stories inside out, so we were always at loggerheads, and he'd say to me, you know, Daddy, why are there only three dwarves in the story tonight? You know, what happened to Grumpy? And I knew that this was just not the way to be living, but I couldn't somehow get myself out of it until one day I heard about a book called The 1 Minute Bedtime Story, right? So Snow White in 60 seconds, and I caught myself thinking, hallelujah, you know, great idea. I need that book now from Amazon drone delivery. And then I had a second light bulb over the head moment where I thought, whoa, has it really come to this? Am I really in such a hurry? I'm prepared to fop off my little boy with a soundbite instead of a story at the end of the day. And that's when it was like a moment of a searing epiphany. It was like an out-of-body experience. And I just saw myself there, and I thought, wow, you've lost it. You've lost your compass. And that was the starting point for writing my books and for reconnecting with my own inner tortoise.
Carl, you didn't start writing about the slow movement yesterday. You go back on this 15 years or more. How would you make the case for choosing to live frantically and more slowly?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that we are bumping up against the limits of how much speed the human animal can take. You know, we're stuck in fast forward. We're caught in roadrunner mode, and it's taking a horrendous toll on every aspect of our lives. It's harming our health and diet, our relationships and families and communities. It's also taking a toll on our ability to think, learn, teach, innovate, create, or work. We are actually racing through our lives instead of living them now. So the case against this cult of speed is in some ways not a hard one to make, because I think all of us feel the virus of hurry coursing through our veins. We know it's doing us damage. So what are the benefits of slowing down or you know, living at the right speed, not doing everything as fast as possible, but trying to do as well as possible, which is the essence of the slow creed? Well, you know, for a start, people are healthier, right? You're less stressed, you're less exhausted, you're more able to be present and enjoy the moment. You're able to connect more with people, listen and be heard. You communicate better. I think this is a compelling case for slowing down in the workplace, you know, so that people can focus, make fewer mistakes. There's an intimate, deep bond between slowness and creativity. It's when we slow down, let the mind wander, reflect, that we unleash our creative fire. And then I think there's an existential case for making this move to living more slowly, and that is that when you're stuck in fast forward, you only really skim the surface of things. You never have time to confront the big questions, such as, who am I? Am I living the right life for me? What is my purpose? Because you're always caught up in the small questions, you know, the small stuff, like, where are my keys? I'm late for my 11 a.m. And when you slow down, I think that's one of the things you reclaim. you move from a life that's black and white to one that's technicolor, but you also move from a life that's shallow to one that's deep. There's depth, there's texture, there's meaning there that I think we often lose when we get stuck in a fast way of living.
So there's a real toll to this quick fix mentality, as you're mentioning, both individually. But I'm curious, what's the impact on society?
The impact on society of our speed culture, Dean?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think let's take loneliness, right? I mean, we are more connected now electronically than ever before, and yet most of the research suggests that there's an awful lot of isolation, a lot of loneliness. And I think that's because one thing that you cannot accelerate is human relationships, right? No matter how much of a rush you're in, you can't make someone fall in love with you faster. It doesn't work that way, right? These things have a natural arc, a natural rhythm, and they need time. And when we rush through our days, our evenings, we don't connect fully with other people. And I think that's why many of us, you know, live in big cities surrounded by other people but feel very cut off and very alone.
Do you think that people are afraid to do this, or maybe just don't know how to do it?
I think that slowing down for a lot of people is frightening for two reasons. One, we are actually now speed junkies. I mean, we are chemically addicted to speed. They've done research showing that when you take people off that high-speed treadmill or you take away their smartphone, that they respond in the same way that heroin junkies do when you take away their fix. You know, we are actually hooked on the adrenaline rush and that constant barrage of dopamine squirts that is modern life. We are actually speed junkies now, and so it's frightening to contemplate slowing down, I think, on a physical, biological, even cellular level. But there's also a metaphysical dimension, I think, as well. For many of us, speed, busyness, distraction, they all add up to a mechanism of denial. They are a way of walling ourselves off from or avoiding those deeper questions that I was mentioning earlier. You know, who am I? Am I living the right life for me? All those big questions, which take time and can be uncomfortable to grapple with, but actually grappling with them is what life is all about. But I think at first it can be a little bit scary. So we fill ourselves up with distraction, stimulation, multitasking, speed, busyness, impatience, often I think as a way of avoiding living deeply, because living deeply can be a little bit scary for people. And maybe that's why therapists often say that the final stage before burnout is one last burst of acceleration, you know, as though the person were desperately trying to outrun all those problems until crash, you know, smashing into the brick wall, having a burnout, and then being forced by ill health and a meltdown to confront those big questions. And I think it's telling that not many people have two burnouts, right? You know, once you're actually forced to stop physically and then forced at the same time to think deeply, to reflect on who you are, the life you're building, where you're going, people will go back to their lives. They may go back to the same career, the same job, roughly the same life, but they'll always go back with a different spirit, I think, a spirit that I would describe as slow, you know, with more slowness in the equation.
If it's okay with you, I'd like to shift gears to a related topic, and that's getting older. We're all getting older every day. And I wonder your perspective on how can cultural messages shape how some people think about that, about getting older?
Well, I think our problem now is that we live in a cult of youth. We're marinated in this idea that younger is always better, and that the very idea of growing older is attached to shame and guilt and fear and dread. And that cultural message is coming at us from all angles all the time. And I think it's crippling and damaging, and it's actually backfires on us in so many ways, because if the research shows very clearly that if you have a downbeat, grim view of growing older, then you are going to grow older less well. You know, you're going to age less well. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And in my new book, Boulder, I look at, you know, the upsides of aging, of which there are many, but we don't often hear about them. Right? All we hear about is the downside. We're always being told that that growing older is a chamber of horrors, and from the age of whatever, I don't know, 30, 35, 40, wherever you draw the line now, it's all downhill. It's a spiral downwards to dementia and decrepitude and decline and depression and debt and everything bad, right? And I think that means that we are doing aging all wrong, right? So we're actually living in the beginnings, I think, of a golden age of aging. And it's never been a better time in human history to grow older. And so we're living longer and we're living healthier. And this extraordinary demographic bounty is spreading out before us. And yet we are still imprisoned by this cult of youth straitjacket that poisons our view of growing older. So I think that explains a lot of the tension we feel and see in our culture around the whole idea of aging. You know, we should be embracing, we should be cracking open the champagne and saying, wow, look at what we can carry on doing right up to our, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. People, I mean, Sir David Attenborough in his 90s, you know, traveling around the world as an amazing environmental campaigner. I mean, there's so much life to be lived and lived well, and yet we find ourselves painted into this gloomy corner that says, you know, you should be ashamed of growing older, and it's a terrible, terrible thing.
We share your view. And you mentioned upsides. What upsides do you see to growing older?
Well, when I set out to write the book, I was definitely a card-carrying ageist, right? I held that Chamber of Horrors view. I thought it was all downhill. And yet, clearly, it's not. I mean, there's so many reasons why. Let's start with, you know, life satisfaction and happiness, right? What they call the U-shaped happiness curve, which shows that people are pretty happy in early, you know, childhood. Then it kind of goes down, and it bottoms out somewhere in middle age, and then goes up again. And in fact, in most of the developed world, you'll find that the adult cohort that reports the highest level of life satisfaction and happiness is the over 60s, right? You know, which goes completely against the dominant narrative, which tells us that old equals sad, old is miserable, you know, cantankerous, grumpy old man, grumpy old, all those cliches we have about older people, when in fact, they're often the happiest people in the room, right? So that's one benefit. Another is that we become, generally speaking, more at ease in our own skin. We have a kind of self-confidence, I think, about ourselves and how we fit into the world. Ann Landers, the famous agony aunt, once said that at 20, we worry about what other people think of us. At 40, we stop worrying about what others think of us. And then at 60, we realize that they were never thinking about us at all, right? Which I think underscores that upside, that we just mind less about what other people think. We cast off the shackles of other people's expectations as we grow older. And that brings a lightness, I think, to later life, and probably explains partly this surge in happiness, perhaps, and life satisfaction. We're just less beholden, less pinned down, and less hemmed in by what other people think. We just kind of know ourselves better, and we just go on out there and do what suits us, right? Which is kind of what life should all be about at every age, not just in later life. So that's another benefit. And then another one that I think is quite surprising to people is that actually in the workplace, people get more productive as they get older. I mean, there's this awful toxic ageism in especially the American workplace, but I think you find it all over the world too. This idea, you know, in Silicon Valley, they talk about it being finished at 40, and, you know, anybody over 40 gets passed over for interviews and shunted into less interesting work and all this sort of stuff. And yet, people are on an upward curve of performance, you know, as they grow older. Productivity goes up in jobs that rely on social skills. People get better, you know, with dealing with customers and clients, better at things like collaboration, listening, seeing the big picture. Creativity holds strong, and there's a lot of research, in fact, that suggests that it gets better. We become more creative as we get older. We loosen up. We join the dots better. And even in the startup world, right, we're always shown this image of planet entrepreneur as being dominated by, you know, teenagers and 20-somethings, and you think of Mark Zuckerberg and all that stuff. And in fact, Mark Zuckerberg famously once said to an audience in public in Stanford, he said, young people are just smarter. And you think, wow. I mean, there in a few words, in a nutshell, is the cult of youth, right, in its purest form, especially in the workplace. And yet, what happens in the entrepreneurial startup world? They crunched the numbers and looked at all of the new businesses set up in the United States between 2007 and 2014, and the conclusion was crystal clear that the most successful age group in that wave of business creation was not 20-somethings. It was actually middle-aged people, and this is a direct quote from the study, middle-aged people or beyond, right? So in the culture, we see The Apprentice, for instance, and it's, you know, teens, what, 20-somethings, right, or 30, 30-somethings who are strutting and preening around on TV there. But actually, in the real startup world, it's their parents and grandparents who are smashing it. So the truth is that there's so much that we can all bring to the party in later life if we can just get past this downbeat narrative that says it's all over from age X, right? Because it's not.
I see a connection between the slowness approach to you know, the mindset and this whole transition to appreciating the fact that you're getting older. There are so many positives, and I love that concept of creativity. You know, we can be more creative as we get older. So
I appreciate the
connections you make in here. I think they're really good for our listeners.
And that's always been the case. I mean, you look back through history of, you know, art. You think of, you know, Matisse, Michelangelo, Bach, Beethoven doing triumphantly creative work towards the end of their lives. I mean, this is nothing new. It just runs against this cult of youth narrative, which says, you know, creativity, energy, even sex and role, all those things are for the young when they're just not. And it I think there's an interesting bridge there to be made between slowing down and aging, because of course in some ways, you know, especially physically in sports, I'm a big sports guy, you know, you lose some of your speed. We all know that, right? Your physical speed. You may lose a little bit of, you know, processing speed in your brain in terms of retrieving certain short-term memories. We all have that feeling of, you know, something on the tip of our tongue, you know, getting to our 40s and 50s, so start forgetting a word here and there or something. But basically, people carry on can be, you know, nimble cognitively and pretty nimble physically all the way up. But I think that the connection I make with slowing down is that one of the, again, because our culture is so anti-slow, that we regard slowing down as a bad thing. And I think that feeds into the cult of, so let's put it this way, the cult of speed kind of bolsters the cult of youth, because of course youth, you've got a bit more of that kind of physical speed, especially. But there, as I've done with my earlier books, looking at the benefits of slowness, I think you look at aging, some of that slowness is actually a really good thing. It's kind of a blessing. I think it explains why as we get older, we get better at pausing. People seem to be better at being in the moment, at seeing the bigger picture. Those things all come from slowing down, and we can do them. We can channel that, you know, tortoise mode in earlier years, but I think it becomes easier for us as we grow older. And I was just talking to my own father, so he's now grandfather because I got children, and we were talking about these sorts of things, and he said one of the best things is that that slowness allows you, you know, when you come back as a parent or as a grandparent the second time, you just, I don't know, you find it easier to be present with your grandchildren than you did when you were a parent somehow. And I think I see that in my own life, that partly it's because you're less busy, but I think because you're not working anymore, you're retired and so on. But if you see families interacting, it's very often the grandparent that just has that patience to sit with a small child and listen to all those stories or watch them build a tower and break it and build it again endlessly, right? Whereas I think when we're in our 30s and we're parents, we kind of think, okay, I've seen that tower built once, let's move on now, right? Well, hurry up and tell me the story because I got to get, you know, I think we have less patience. And I think maybe there's an argument to be made there connecting slowness and aging and seeing them both in a positive light, that we do gain the capacity to give the moment the time and space it needs to blossom, right? Whether that's with a child, a partner, a client, anything, right? Just the moment. And I think that's one thing that you do definitely hear with people as they grow older. And now I'm myself 51. I know that I'm way better at just kind of falling and allow myself fall into a moment and not rush through it than I was when I was 23.
We both took away a lot of great things from your new book, Bolder. What would you like to highlight for our listeners about your new book, Bolder, Making the Most of Our Longer Lives?
Well, what I'll do is I've got a kind of list of 12, you know, tips for aging boldly. I can send you that and we can post that on the page. But, you know, there's the obvious things for how to think about aging better and on your own terms. You know, we've all heard the advice about, you know, eating well and exercise, and those things are all true. But I want to draw attention to two that I think jump out and maybe are slightly surprising to people. And one is the importance of language. Right? I think so much of the problem with our attitude to aging now is bound up with the poisonous language we use. You know, it's woven into our vernacular that younger is better and older is worse. When we forget something, we call it a senior moment, right? Or we, you know, that phrase, finished at 40, or you're the wrong side of 30, or the wrong side of 40, or you say you're feeling your age, and that means you feel weak and feeble and inferior or sore. And it's just, every time we use that language, I think it's reinforcing that stereotype. It's reinforcing the caricature. It's reinforcing the wrong idea of aging. And as we know from whether it's dealing with racism or sexism or any kind of social change, language is one of the first steps towards changing how we feel about ourselves and our place in the world and changing how we behave is the words we use. So I just recommend that people just push pause, you know, think a little bit, check your language a little bit, you know, just don't use phrases like senior moment. Try and use phrases that are kind of neutral about aging or upbeat about it. And I think that can make a difference. I mean, certainly there's a lot of studies that show that if you have an upbeat view of aging, you age better, you know, you live longer, you're better physically, cognitively, happier, et cetera. So language is a good way, I think, to do that. And as a kind of footnote to that, I would say honesty is another important part of this equation. Because we have such a negative view of aging, we're dishonest. We lie about our age, right? If you type into Google, I lie about my, the number one answer is age, right? We're always pretending to, or we talk about 60 being the new 40 or 50 being the new 30 as though reaching 60 or 50 was somehow something to avoid rather than aspire to. And I think if you lie about your age, if you pretend to be an age that's younger than you are, what you're doing there is you are giving the number terrible power over you that it doesn't deserve. And I think that owning your age, saying I'm whatever it is, 45, 64, 83, whatever it is, owning that is the first step to making the most of that age. I think it moves you away from those stereotypes and let's face it, I mean, being honest about who we are is just a healthier thing all around, whatever it is. And then I'll throw in a third one, which I think may be surprising to people, and I found it very interesting as well when I was doing the book, is the importance of thinking about death. Because of course one of the reasons I think that aging gets a bad name is that it leads us to death, right? I mean, you know, it's a reminder as we age, it's a reminder that the Grim Reaper is waiting for us at the end of the track, and that's not something anyone wants to contemplate. But I think part of the problem nowadays, this ageism culture, is that we don't think about death. We've kind of outsourced it. We put it out of our minds. And that allows the sort of worst-case scenario view to take shape, and it allows the worst stereotypes to crowd in. I think it's very healthy to think about death, not in a morbid, obsessive way, obviously, but just from time to time, just to be aware. Because if you are aware of death, you're aware that you've got a finite amount of time, I think that bookends your life in a sense. It gives it shape, gives it meaning, and it also spurs you to make the most of the time you have left, to make the most of the here and now, which is really the main message of my book, I think, which is the title is, you know, Bolder, Making the Most of Your Longer Life. But in a sense, the way to make the most of your longer life is to make the most of the here and now, whether you're 42, 52, 62, whatever age you are, is to look at who you are and say, how can I make the most of this moment? Not worrying about what the number is on the birth certificate or what other people are doing. What can I do to make the most of it? And weirdly, thinking about death a little bit from time to time, I think can push us more in that direction. That's why, you know, many of the great religions from Hinduism to Buddhism have what they call death meditations, where people think about death from time to time. And the reason is not to depress you. It's to lift you up, right? It's to send you back into your daily life thinking, yeah, I've got there's an end point here. And so therefore, I'm going to live this moment now to the fullest. And in a sense, that's what I think the core message of the book is that let's all make the most of the here and now. And there are many different ways to age. There's not one way to do it. It's about finding your own path and your own formula. Because for most of us nowadays, the biggest problem is not aging, it's ageism.
Listeners will find a list of your 12 recommendations in the show notes. I'm curious about what advice you would offer someone listening who does want to make the most of the here and now, make the most of their longer life. What one or two things in that list would you recommend they start with?
I would say learning, right? Do something new. Novelty keeps you energized and engaged. And you know, of course, the old saying that you can't teach an old dog new tricks isn't even true of dogs, right? And it's certainly not true of human beings. In fact, learning, experimenting, trying new things is the soul of life. I mean, that's how you work out who you are, what works for you. It also keeps you, you know, fighting fit. So I would say, you know, always push that envelope, open new doors instead of closing doors. So that would be a first suggestion. A second would be to channel Marie Kondo in a way. You know, so if something, a job or a friendship or something is just no longer sparking joy, drop it, right? I mean, we cannot do everything. Nobody can have it all. and not everything works for everyone. So streamline, right, to make every moment count. Those would be two suggestions I'd make. And then maybe a third one to throw in there is to cultivate a sense of humor. Laughing, you know, we know that physically it boosts health and longevity. I mean, George Bernard Shaw famously said, you don't stop laughing when you grow old, you grow old when you stop laughing. And there's something about humor that just electrifies us, you know, refreshes us and keeps us connected to other people. And humor is also a very good way of taking down stereotypes and changing how people think. So, tip three in that sense would be laugh lots, right? See the funny side of things, because there's always a funny side out there.
And that's the perfect note to end on, the sense of humor. Really appreciate all of the information that you've shared, Carl. And we look forward to following you in the future and continue to see what you come up with.
Excellent. Been a pleasure.
So, Dennis, what did you find notable in that conversation with Carl Honoré?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Well, I wrote down a couple of key phrases as some takeaways. First phrase I wrote down was slow down and stop racing through our lives. And the second one was make the most of the here and now. And those both resonated with me pretty strongly. In line with those, I noted some benefits of slowing down on our health, our ability to focus, our ability to communicate better, and to connect more deeply with others. Carl mentioned that there's also a link between slowing down and increased creativity. And I see this as a benefit, especially as we age, in that creativity can really support our continued personal growth. So slowing down is a good thing as we age. It can have some really good benefits. Also, he spoke about the fact that slowing down may be hard for many people, and people may in effect be afraid of it, as they are addicted to this very fast pace of life today. And the busyness and distraction can add up to, I think he called it, a mechanism of denial and avoidance, which prevents a person, ourselves, from deeper reflection about ourselves and actually perhaps living more deeply. So I think we need to ask ourselves, can we afford not to slow down and keep denying ourselves of this inner awareness, which can be very powerful and helpful for us? Joe, what about yourself?
A few things. The first is his description of the influence of society and trends. He described one as cults, but there are really two, the cult of speed and the cult of youth. And when he's talking about speed, I thought it was very interesting that he mentioned that when you do slow down, if you choose to, it creates space to tackle some of the bigger questions like purpose and meaning. I thought that was notable. And then he also talked about the fact that some things don't work at the speed you force. So he talked about really some things like relationships, you can't accelerate. They have their own natural pace to their evolution. And it reminded me of one of my favorite Stephen Covey, the author of 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, stories, where he calls it the law of the farm. And this is timely. We're recording this about a week or so ahead of springtime. And if you go out to plant a garden, if you try to use speed, you might water it furiously, break out the Miracle-Gro 6 times a day, and you're probably not going to get the result you want. Some things you just can't rush. And I thought that was a very insightful point that Carl made. On the cult of youth, very powerful force in society, as he highlighted ageism. We've talked about that many times. He made some unique points, I thought, about the fact that you have a choice there. You can choose to own your own age. You can be honest about things, and that is very helpful, pays multiple benefits. He had some great stories about that that illustrated that point. And also that you can also choose to pick your attitude. You don't have to focus on negative issues, negative factors, that many people tend to take those as points of fact when many of them are not. And you can really begin to focus on the upsides and begin to move toward focusing on making the most out of here and now. I thought those were very insightful. Next was learning. You talked about the power of learning, getting involved in something new, seeking the opportunity to learn new things, and trying new things. Very empowering, very powerful. And then finally, the one that got my attention at the very end was sense of humor, cultivate a sense of humor. So I think these are serious topics and serious issues, but lightening up on them from time to time can also be very helpful in changing perspective.
Thanks for joining us today on The Retirement Conversation. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.